The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
Edition of Thought Crime Radio, because the media never stops lying, and so we're here to open some eyes, hopefully. And with me on the phone, I have Patricia, the hypnotherapist from Oregon.
Hello.
Hi there. Don't hypnotize us, okay? I'm not sure that's within FCC guidelines.
1, 2, 3, bam.
That doesn't sound very hypnotic.
I don't do that kind of hypnosis. I do de-hypnosis. I de-hypnotize people from their trauma.
Yeah, can you go into that a little bit and explain how virtually this entire population has been traumatized on a very deep imprinting type level?
Mm, boy, well, you start with birth, if not even before that. But the way that people are birthed in this country is so far from natural that it's amazing that we turn out as well as we do even. But there's a lot of very unnatural stuff that happens with American births. They rush the mother along. You really want to hear all this? Anyway,
well, I know,
we
I
are hypnotized into believing that we're not safe. How's that? We believe that we are under duress from birth. And then your favorite subject and mine, the circumcision, happens to most boys. Now, apparently no longer. Apparently now it's less than half. Apparently it's only 33%. But for many years it was way higher than that. And hopefully it's going to...
It was over 95%, I think, at one time. And
they
didn't ask the parents or anything. And this,
right.
You know, people need to understand that we're talking about imprinting. You know, everybody understands that animals imprint. And American obstetrics in particular has been imprinting newborn babies with an amazing message that you better shut up and sit down and take orders or we're going to torture you.
And resistance is futile.
Right.
And you are not safe here, and you had better not question authority.
Right.
So I think that's how it continues, is that there's that very strong message, do not question authority. So then, you know, they have children. They are traumatized. They have children. And they do not dare question. So then it just keeps going on and on and on.
Yeah, the authority, you know, the pivotal moment of birth, that's when the authority of medicine takes over and preempts parental instincts and, you know, the natural divine love that a parent has for her newborn, his or her newborn baby. So in keeping with this whole brainwashing paradigm and the slave mentality of the society, and I do mean slave, you know, circumcision is an instrument of slavery because it blinds us to our true potential as our true emotional and spiritual potential to rise above our indoctrination and see the eternal connection that we have with each other and with the cosmos in general. Because
it fixates us in fear.
Right.
And it fixates us on our bodies. So that then we believe that we are mortal, funky little mortal beings who are so vulnerable. And so we need to be afraid. And so, you know, then we just never come back to our full potential.
Right.
Although we can, you know, many people do pursue it. And you can reclaim yourself. But, you know, most people are just sitting in front of their television sets with a remote and a beer and some pretzels. And, you know, that's as good as it gets as far as they're concerned because they don't dare even hope for more.
Yeah, and we'll get more into the, at another show, we'll get more into the, you know, we keep belaboring this circumcision issue because, well, partly because no one else is talking about it. It's still going on under our noses. It's extremely destructive to a newborn baby's life, and it has completely warped the not just the sociological but the political aspects of our society. And I think this is very much in evidence in how this society has reacted to the 9/11 false flag operation, when most of the rest of the world is well past questioning the official story and gone on to investigate what actually did happen. So in keeping with that that approach, you know, we like to link the political with the extremely personal on this show, because politics is very personal. And so I would like to play a cut here from a press conference from the Firefighters for 9/11 Truth.
Thank you very much. And like Richard said, my name is Eric Lawyer, and I founded the Firefighters for 9/11 Truth after I watched Richard in one of his presentations, and I realized that something more had to be done. And I just want to thank Richard for everything he's doing here, and the Firefighters for 9/11 Truth strongly support Richard Gage and all the architects and engineers that have the courage to sign that petition. And I know from personal experience there's about 5 times as many out there that believe what we believe but don't have the courage to sign it. So what I'm hoping today is that people will find the courage after listening to this presentation and seeing everybody here and seeing that we are behind it. We also demand an investigation that follows the national standards and has contempt and subpoena powers. 9/11 was the greatest loss of life and property damage in U.S. fire history. This should have been the most protected, preserved, over-tested, and thorough investigation of a crime scene in world history. Sadly, it was not. What was it? Well, we know from their own admission, the majority of the evidence was destroyed. Like Richard said, 22 years of experience, I've seen a lot of crime scenes. I've never seen anything like this in my life. I was out at the site. I saw trucks leaving faster than, you know, anywhere I've ever seen, but I accepted it at the time, and for years I accepted it because it was a recovery and rescue operation, and that's normal to have something like that going. Again, we've never seen anything like it, but that was expected. What I didn't know for years, what was going on behind the scenes, was that evidence was being destroyed when it was shipped off. By their own admission, Tower 7 investigation, this investigation in Tower 7 had no physical evidence. How do you investigate a crime when you've destroyed all the evidence? It doesn't make sense. They also admit that they refused to test the explosives or to test for explosives or residue of thermite. Now, this is what I'm going to go into here just real quickly, is there are national standards for an investigation. That's what all of us are asking for, an investigation that follows national standards and holds people accountable. This manual right here, just so you can see it, is what we call the kind of the Fire Investigation 101. This is the most basic fire investigation manual there. This is for the 2001 edition. This is what should have been referred to, at least. It doesn't have to be followed exactly, but it should have been used as a guideline for the investigation. I'm just going to cover a few of the things that are in here. So NIST violated, and the initial investigators that did not protect the scene violated the most basic of the guidelines. And I'm going to cover five of them here. One is the NFPA 9.3.6. It covers spoliation of evidence. What it reads is once evidence has been removed from the scene, it should be maintained and not destroyed or altered until the investigation is complete. The steel was melted down prior to the investigation. We know that from their own admission. This is no conspiracy theory stuff. 19.2.4, exotic accelerants. If on the scene you find melted steel or concrete, you should consider the use of exotic accelerants. And they specifically say in the manual, thermite mixtures produce exceedingly hot fires that can account for melted steel and concrete. It also says they leave residues that can be tested for visually and chemically identifiable. Again, they did not test for it. And just put in perspective, on a routine house fire, if we suspect even the slightest use of an accelerant, we're going to test for it when there's no fatalities, when there's very little property damage. So to not do it on this, there is absolutely no excuse. I can't drive that point home enough. 18.15 is analyze fuel source. All available fuel sources should be considered and eliminated until one fuel can be identified as meeting all the physical damage criteria. For example, if you find pulverized concrete, which we all know there was in all three buildings, there was pulverized concrete, the only fuels that can create seated explosions should be considered. So they shouldn't be considering fires. They shouldn't be doing that. It doesn't account for pulverized concrete. They should only be considering exotic accelerants and explosives. 19.4.8.2.6, extremism. The terrorist may include fire as but one of a variety of weapons along with explosives used in furthering his or her goal. We know they used them in 93.
Actually, I'd like to interrupt at that point because we know that the FBI used high explosives in 93, in the World Trade Center bombing in 93. We know that because of sworn affidavits taken out by the FBI's own informant. We know that the informant supplied the explosives that were used in that bombing in which six Americans were murdered by the FBI because they committed the crime of being at the wrong place in the wrong time, at a time when the government wanted to do a terrorist attack to bring about a clampdown on civil liberties in this country, in which they are certainly well advanced at this point. Let me continue.
Why would we not test for them now? There was reports that day, multiple reports, which I'll get into in a second. So they could have put them in the basement. How do we know that unless we test for it? I mean, even if it is the terrorists that they claim they are, we need to test this. 14.3, preservation of the fire scene and physical evidence. We find the following. The cause of a fire explosion is not known until near the end of the investigation. The entire fire scene should be considered physical evidence and should be protected and preserved. It's just over and over. There's so many. You can go to our website, the Firefighters from Island of Truth. We have many more of these actual chapters that cover what they should have done that they did not do. So now, by their own admission, in all three building collapses, NIST refused to physically test, like Dr. Stephen Jones did, for explosives. This is just unbelievable. And here are their excuses, and I quote, "It is unlikely that 100 pounds of thermite or more could have been carried into World Trade Center 7 and placed around columns without being detected, either prior to September 11th or during that day." So again, I've been on a lot of fire scenes, and I've seen a lot of investigations, and why would we not test because something's hard to do? That's the exact reason you need to investigate it. If that was hard to do, we need to find out how they did it. And number two, NIST excuse. In addition, no blast sounds were heard on the audio tracks or the video recordings during the collapse of World Trade Center 7 or reported by witnesses. That's one of the excuses why they didn't test. Well, apparently they didn't read Chapter 18. 18 is the general definition of explosions. Although an explosion is almost always accompanied by the production of a loud noise, the noise itself is not, in big bold letters, an essential element in the definition of an explosion. The generation and violent escape of gases are the primary criteria of an explosion. So that alone says they should have tested for it. But then we also, NIST has lied, and we can prove it. As soon as the new investigation happens, the evidence is out there for you to see right now. We have 118 first responders who reported explosions. We have the radio transmissions from FDNY members that are still recorded today that reported explosions. We have audio recordings. We have video recordings. I've personally talked to witnesses that heard them. So there's nothing short of saying they lied, and they need to be held accountable. And besides that, like I said, there is no excuse for not testing for explosives. And so at the very least, at the very best, even if you want to believe the official story, this was the most incompetent investigation of all time. And I've talked to a lot of investigators that were there, and I asked them the specific question, why did they refuse to test? They weren't the ones who refused, but NIST did. And they said, all we can say, you know, all they can answer is incompetence, or they tell me to shut up. They cannot give me any reason that follows national standards. So, but the reality, after, you know, all the research everybody here and the incredible people were in the room with today have done, the reality is it was a criminal investigation to cover up the crime. So, I'd like to read a quote. This is from a retired, decorated FDNY lieutenant. Anyone who knows the fire service, he is a stud. He worked on Ladder Company 26, Rescue Company 3, Rescue Company 1 in his career. Anyone who knows, those are amazing companies. Here's his comment. Trade Tower 7 by itself is the smoking gun. Not hit by an aircraft with only a few relatively small fires, it came down in a classic crimp and implosion, going straight into its basement. Something only very precise demolitions can accomplish, which takes days, if not weeks, to prepare. The 9/11 Commission didn't even mention it, and FEMA actually stated they didn't know why it collapsed and left it at that. Brothers, I know that the above implications are hard, almost unthinkable, but the official explanation is utter nonsense, and 343 of our murdered brothers are crying out for justice.
Yeah. Okay, so that now we have firefighters for 9/11. We already have scholars for 9/11 truth, architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, intelligence officers for 9/11 truth, veterans for 9/11 truth, and fire. It's ridiculous. I mean,
it's about one group for every person in the country.
Yeah, no. And that's just in the United States. I mean, they've had hearings in the Japanese diet, whatever they call it, before the European Commission about the insanity of the official story, how it's not physical, how it can't possibly be true, and so I want to go to the next segment here. This is from last Wednesday's Guns and Butter show on KPFA in Berkeley. She has done a bang-up job covering 9/11 issues for many years, and her archives are just a treasure trove of information. And really, it was listening to her show that first woke me up several years ago.
Today on Guns and Butter, Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff. Today's show, Censored 2011. Today, September 15th, is the official launch date for the new annual Project Censored book, including the top 25 news stories of the past year. This year's book includes an introduction by journalist Christina Borgeson. And in addition to the top 25 stories, the 25 top runners-up, the top 10 from Germany, a section on truth emergency, and Project Censored International. I caught up with Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff at Sonoma State University. Mickey, have there been any attempts to censor Project Censored?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question, because that has happened. I mean, we've, of course, had our detractors and people that, some people had claimed that, well, we don't really deal with censored stories because these are stories that are published. And particularly some of the independents that we republished their stories. I say, well, I published that. That story wasn't censored. But it really doesn't address the actual meaning of modern media censorship. And that is that anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that's democratic and purports to have a free press is a form of censorship. So we're really dealing here with censorship of degree. We have had our detractors and critics, but we've also had issues of censorship. One, actually, we talk about in the book this year in the Truth Emergency section. Both Peter and I had written op-ed pieces for a very long time for a variety of people. Peter certainly longer than myself. With Minuteman Media, and it was taken over by a Washington think tank, a sort of a left-leaning, left-progressive think tank, the Institute for Policy Studies. And so Peter had been submitting op-eds according to contract, and we had done some pieces together, one on global starvation and hunger, and another was on, of course, some on foreign policy, the war issues, and so forth. But we submitted one this past spring, and it footed the bill. It was well within the parameters of the contract. fact, and this had never happened before. And Peter's been doing this for over a decade, and I've been doing it for some time now. And we've never had an op-ed piece that we were contracted to do rejected, outright rejected. And it wasn't just rejected because of some contractual issue or violation. We were actually told specifically from people at IPS that because we mentioned as part of a piece on state crimes against democracy, Lance DeHaven Smith, David Ray Griffin talk about these problems, like from Watergate to Iran-Contra and so forth. And of course, what we're suggesting is that the events of September 11th have all the trappings of a potential state crime against democracy. And so we mentioned the scientific studies done by Stephen Jones and the Open Chemical Physics Journal, and we included Richard Gage and the Architects and Engineers Group, over 1,200 professionals now saying that the story, the official story and the official quote-unquote science just doesn't make sense and doesn't add up. I mean, it defies what we know about scientific methodology and so forth. And so Peter and I included those examples, academic research pieces, fully noted. And, I footnoted this piece, and it was 2 pages of footnotes for a 1.5-page article. So we were serious about it. And they literally told us that they were not going to publish anything that talked about 9/11. And we were dumbfounded. You know, at first we were waiting for the laugh tracks to come up and everything to be like, oh, we're censoring Project Censored. But no, they were deadly serious. They said, no, we're not going to run this, and we will not run anything on 9/11. And so we had it, we subsequently put it up on the web and Global Research on our own website, and, several sites picked it up. But the fact that there was a topic at the Progressive IPS that just could not be discussed. And if you have a free press structure, there is no subject that cannot be discussed. So yes, the irony there is that Project Censored was censored.
Did the Institute for Policy Studies give you a reason why they wouldn't publish anything on 9/11?
So one of the claims was that it was a divisive issue, and I mean that's rubbish. I mean, it's a divisive issue for sure, but it's contentious for a reason. And these are the very kind of subjects that, in a free press structure, we ought to be ferreting out and having the debate. I mean, that's the purpose of a free press. And and here we are seeing with the good lefties, right? And we're expecting, oh, they're going to want to do this. It's a power elite story. It's a story of mass potential propaganda and deception that gets us into 2 illegal wars, eviscerates constitutional liberties, bankrupts the society both economically and morally the world over. You'd think this is a huge thing, debate on the merits of science and fact, right? We were hard, concrete scientific reports and peer-reviewed journal articles and so on, and we're saying, what's the deal with this? Why can't we talk about this? And they said, well, you're going to alienate readers in the heartland. I'm not kidding. I'm not sure where this heartland is, coming from the Beltway of Washington, D.C., but that was literally a claim that was made. And, of course, our retort was, well, aren't these the very people that we want to try to reach with difficult stories? I mean, isn't it the role of a progressive left-leaning institute with social justice values to try to push some of the most difficult things in the heartland? I mean, aren't they trying to woo these people in some way, the populist people of the heartland? But according to the people at IPS, the answer was no. So they didn't run it. And then when Peter submitted another piece the month later, they said, you're no longer writing for us.
That is truly incredible that in a nation that supposedly has a free press, that something wouldn't be printed because it was considered divisive.
Yeah, again, the irony, the paradox, it's all just perplexing to us. And we did write about it. We thought long and hard about this, too. Even to add to the irony, we were literally invited to speak at the IPS headquarters in Washington, D.C. after they censored the piece. And we showed up there prepared to talk about what had happened and to talk about the piece. And we discovered that many of the people on the staff had no knowledge that this was ever done. We passed the piece around to the people that were there, and the consensus in the room was this should never have happened, that the piece should run, and we should be talking about difficult issues, and that organizations such as theirs should be spotlighting them. I mean, they should be leading the charge in terms of like a quality muckraking style of reporting and academic studies and research and so forth. But again, it was a really odd thing for us, and again, Project Censored was used to getting attacked and, labeled and dismissed or ignored by the mainstream corporate media, certainly. But getting censored was an interesting phenomenon.
Well, even after you showed up in person, then, did they change their policies toward Project Censored or not?
No. Peter and I no longer write for IPS, formerly Minuteman.
And you can see the same process going on at every level of the society. Right here in Columbia, Missouri, the activist groups that claim to be, pursuing an anti-war agenda, you know, they go out in the streets and carry signs talking about how it's not nice to kill innocent people and, you know, platitudes like that. I mean, I'm not trying to put them down or anything, but if you're not talking about the lie that underlines the entire war agenda and the dismantling of the Constitution and civil liberties and the bankrupting of the Treasury and the impoverishment of the people of this country, you're irrelevant. I'm sorry, but that's just the facts. Patricia, do you have anything to say?
Well, I always wonder how a good Christian nation or a good Jewish nation or even a good Islamic nation that all believe in the Ten Commandments could possibly go to war. Thou shalt not kill, supposedly.
Apparently.
So I don't know. I've always wondered that. How do we justify it?
Well, more to the point, it seems to me, we need to be asking the question, shouldn't there be a commandment to not be so gullible, to just open your eyes and start thinking, you know? God gave you a brain for a purpose, you know? You're not supposed to just march around and take orders without thinking. And unfortunately, that's what the society's been doing for quite a while. And
that's part of the birth trauma.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
The birth trauma starts us off in fear and afraid of authority. So, you know, we don't dare think. We don't dare question. We don't dare challenge until we get to be really old and like you and me, and we just say, so what?
Yeah,
we're
so going to
ask questions.
Absolutely.
we're going to talk about this stuff because it's important.
Okay, here's another clip.
Okay.
So, Mickey, of the 25... top most censored stories of your new Censored 2011. Do you have a favorite?
We have stories on, you know, the global plans to replace the dollar, our number one story this year. Problems with the H1N1 swine flu pandemic, where there was manipulated research and so forth to benefit drug companies and so on. But, you know, in all of these stories, we include the problems that are ongoing with 9/11 research. So it's not just that's all we're dealing with, but we're one of the few organizations that seem to understand and at least have the courage to address there are factual known problems with the 9/11 Commission report, with the National Institute of Standards and Technologies report, with the FEMA studies, particularly involving Building 7 in New York. As well as all the other hosts of anomalies that came out through, you know, the commission studies and so forth. But this year, there were several really major 9/11 related stories that the corporate media just did not deal with at all. One was, of course, the architects and engineers announcing they had over 1,000 supporters of professional physicists, civil engineers, architects, and so on, signing on, saying that what happened in the official descriptions and official quote-unquote scientific conclusions based on National Institute of Standards and Technologies are impossible. They don't add up. They don't work. And in fact, the government's own studies admit in many cases that they didn't look at all the data or they deny certain facts and so forth. So you can't really even have a debate about it. But they announced that in San Francisco in February, and Sean Hamilton covered that story, and he was basically one of the very few people that covered. I know you, of course, had involvement in that because it's something that you do as a real journalist. But there wasn't it was as if it didn't happen. You know, here you have an example where there's over 1,000 professional experts in a certain field saying not, oh, yes, we absolutely are certain that this happened, but what they're saying is we are absolutely certain that what the government is telling us did not happen, and we need to really take a look at this. And for some reason, that just strikes controversy. But, you know, there's a lot of people in this country, right, left, center, all over the map, that know that there are real problems with 9/11 issues. It's a really broad area of research. research and political interest. But at any rate, there were other stories related to 9/11, specifically Daniel Tenser, how the Obama staffer wanted to reinitiate COINTELPRO, the cognitive infiltration of 9/11 conspiracy groups, as they're labeled. Again, conspiracy theorist is a label to detract people and take away. There's a big difference between conspiracy theorists and people that are conspiracy analysts, because conspiracies happen all the time. And this is a story, of course, about Cass Sunstein, the Harvard lawyer that Obama appointed to a specific post in his administration, where Sunstein's calls to infiltrate private citizen groups, specifically playing to the very concerns of 9/11 activists and the concerns that they may be targeted or infiltrated, tried on some trumped-up terrorist or criminal charges where they may not get a fair public hearing. So this is, again, a climate of fear and intimidation. And historically, this goes back through COINTELPRO days, and this is long documented. This is something that totally happened, and this came out in the Church Committee hearings in the 1970s, and it's been going on. And now this person is publicly, Sunstein is publicly calling to return to these days as if the government should be involved in directly violating the free speech rights of the citizenry. This is pretty amazing. And that story just seems to, again, just float out there and doesn't really get dealt with a whole lot. It's again, a very problematic story. You know, why am I the person that sounds like some paranoid conspiracy theorist or lunatic just because I'm noticing the facts that are in front and I'm willing to accept that maybe this is a possibility? How that makes someone dangerous, I guess you'd have to really go then and look at the whole power elite structure of our government and how they may really not want people to understand or know the truth behind many things that are going on, which of course creates what Peter and I have referred to as a great truth emergency. So I think these are the things that we should be talking about matter-of-factly, transparently, dismissing things that have no factual merit. But you know, again, the role of the free press should be looking at these issues, and given that 9/11 is basically the excuse that's given for almost everything that's gone on almost the past 9 years here, right, 9 years this week, I think we owe it to ourselves as a society to really take seriously these stories.
And Peter, Mickey mentioned and talked a bit about state crimes against democracy. Don't you have a whole table in the book outlining all of these?
Lance DeHaven Smith's article, Beyond Conspiracy Theory, Patterns of High Crime in America, was published by Sage Publications. So this is an academic journal publication. And there's been a number of scholars who have been following this concept, a lot of them in public administration. And it's a whole look at how public the government is. And so if there's incidences inside of government or inside of government and corporations that are in violation of the law, and people are planning this and doing it, that's a conspiracy. But because the word conspiracy has been so mislabeled, it calls these state crimes against democracy, against transparency, against understanding what our government is doing, which is what we, you know, believe we have, or we like to think we have.
Historically, that problem goes back quite a ways. I mean, and then the manufacturing of public support for these kind of wars based on false pretenses. This is, in fact, more the rule than the exception. Sort of, you know, the Mexican-American War in 1846, fought over a trumped-up border dispute that President Polk claimed. I mean, even Abraham Lincoln in the Congress at the time, you know, said it was a complete scam. You know, he said, show me the spot where this happened, you know, and he was nicknamed Spotty Lincoln. He seemed to recover from that politically since he was elected to president later on. But the 1898 Spanish-American War, where the Hearst newspapers claimed and McKinley administration claimed that the USS Maine was attacked by the Spanish in the Havana Harbor. Another bunk story. It was not attacked by the Spanish in the Havana Harbor, but that was used as a pretext for America to take control of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. World War One events, you know, of the Lusitania that were known about in advance. The Zimmerman telegram, the notes of provocation, the erection of a whole propaganda agency in World War One to propagandize and dupe the public into supporting a war by demonizing others and spreading lies about things that were happening. World War II event of Pearl Harbor, another major problem. You know, the book by Robert Stinnett, Day of Deceit, and all these government documents that have come out over the years that show that Pearl Harbor was known about in advance. It was allowed to happen so that there could be public opinion swayed, you know, to go to war against the Nazis and the Japanese. Again, you could argue that that was, you know, justified on some other levels if you like, but that doesn't change the reality or the factual reality of how things were known about at Pearl Harbor and allowed to happen to sway public opinion. I mean, that's like a manufactured kind of event. These are replicated later on. You know, this is where you get into the Gulf of Tonkin. You know, these things are either manufactured or allowed to happen. So given this kind of a track record in history, for us to ignore that when events like Watergate or events like Iran-Contra or events like 9/11 come across our paths, to not look into the possibility of this level of deception is not just sloppy thinking, it's failing to live up to our principles as citizens in a purportedly free society.
Amen. He says it. He says it right off, perfectly. I couldn't agree more. If we are to be worthy citizens, worthy of self-governance, worthy of the legacy of freedom, relative freedom, freedom of expression and, the right to bear arms, the founders didn't include the Second Amendment just because they wanted people to be able to hunt deer or something. I mean, anyone that lived off the land had to have a gun just to hunt deer. They were talking about military arms. They were talking about the people being able to protect themselves from the people who are trying to control the world at this point. I mean, we are literally, to the best of my understanding, this country is is being covertly attacked by the very people, the very institutions anyway, and families that the founders declared independence from in 1776. That's where we're at right now. Everything is coming to a head. Centuries of history have become more and more distilled and compressed, and the aims of these people are becoming more and more obvious. So there's one more clip from this show. Patricia?
Oh, I just think it's incredible that the Internet has allowed so much information to be public so that people can really start finding out all this stuff, Because before you had to be a historian to figure out some of these things, but now it's pretty much just out there. There are complete, collections of the stories throughout history, like that man was talking about.
Right. Okay, let's take in the last segment from Guns and Butter last Wednesday.
Sometimes my favorites don't always even get in the book, but of the list that we've got, number one, I think, is really important. The collapse of the U.S. dollar as a global currency and how that would impact working people in this country is a significant story, and it's literally inevitable. It's going to happen at some point. It may happen slowly or it may happen more quickly, but the dollar being the reserve currency, particularly for buying oil worldwide, is under reconsideration by Russia, China, Japan, India, and their consideration is a UN currency or a trading for oil in yuan, Chinese yuan, or yen, or euros. And, this has been in the works for quite a while. Saddam Hussein was the first country, Iraq, to start selling oil in euros. And you see what happened to him. The first thing we did when we got there, take over the oil ministry and converted Iraq oil sales back to dollars. Trillions and trillions of dollars are out there in the world. The Chinese have a trillion, the Saudis have a trillion, and the balance of trade isn't strong enough that they can spend all that money buying products from the U.S. What it ends up being, they buy treasury bonds. And those treasury bonds are what finance our war, because we're doing deficit spending to create this war, hundreds of billions of dollars, and that costs us these treasury bonds. Now, if nobody's going to buy the treasury bonds, and when we start creating money, like just printing money, that devaluates the dollar automatically, the more you just put out there. And so we're going to see a surplus of dollars in the world that will undermine the value of the dollar in terms of what it'll buy. So if you're going to go buy products in Walmart, and the dollar value has gone down, you could see a doubling of the prices, most of the products from China, in 6 months. So it could really decrease the standard of living for the bottom 80% of us in this country who have essentially only 8% of the wealth. 90% of the wealth is concentrated in the top 20% of the people, half of that in the top 1% of the people. And so the 80% of us who are working class, live paycheck to paycheck, maybe making a mortgage, maybe not, could be literally devastated economically. It's semi-inevitable that that's going to happen in some way. So we're seeing this as our number one story in the censored book this year. And this is coming from Chris Hedges, American Empire is Bankrupt, Michael Hudson, The De-Dollarization, Dismantling America's Financial Military Empire. It also includes stories about how in South America, a new currency is emerging, the Sucre, among the Bolivarian Revolution countries, so that would be Ecuador, Venezuela, Bolivia, Argentina, and they're talking about a trade association with a new currency that they're going to use. So we're seeing that worldwide. So the dominance of the dollar in terms of being the international currency of exchange for oil and a variety of other things is really being undermined, and that will clearly impact living conditions for working people in the United States, more likely sooner than later. And we perceive that as part of the difficulty when they were going to do the bailout, those $700-800 billion bailouts to the bank because of the housing bubble crisis and the subprime mortgage loans defaulting. The part of the message to Congress is if you don't do this, part of the warning was we're going to have civil unrest in the cities and have to declare martial law. So part of the creation of Homeland Security as the command structure for the police departments all over the country, we've seen Operation Falcon, the federal local cops organized nationally, operations of mass arrests. Part of that has been kind of this inevitable possibility that we would have unrest and extremely difficult economic times are potentially possible here, and we have a police state in the making that is ready to deal with that.
That pretty much summarizes our current situation. He doesn't understand, apparently, the cause of this financial meltdown. On the most superficial level, it has to do with mortgages, defaults on mortgages. But all the mortgages in the country going into default could not have produced the current situation. What really is the underlying cause of the whole thing is the derivatives that were based on these mortgages. You know, derivatives are a major problem in the society. They're totally unregulated. People can, people with deep pockets can totally manipulate the financial markets to their own profit very easily using derivatives and futures contracts. And when they go south, when these bets go bad, there isn't enough money in existence to pay off the debt that results, and that's when the U.S. taxpayer comes in and makes good on the debt. It's quite a racket, the impending police state. You know, this mortgage meltdown and the crisis that it created was deliberate. This is not an accident, okay? If you followed the news closely about what was going on at that time, you'll know that these mortgage companies were being instructed, the mortgage officials that dealt with the public, that misled the public into taking out mortgages that they could not afford. This was totally illegal. It's against predatory lending laws. You know, it's up to the bank to determine whether a given customer is actually able to do what the contract stipulates. And they were being told by their superiors to just okay any and every customer that came through there. And at the same time, while this was going on, the Bush administration was suppressing state investigations in all 50 states. All 50 states were trying, the attorneys generals were trying to investigate predatory lending practices in their state. And the Bush administration stepped in, invoked a law from like 1860 or something, to preempt all of these investigations and federalized the whole investigation, and then they did nothing. They stopped it in its tracks, and they sat on it, and they let it fester, and they let it multiply through the derivatives contracts, knowing, you know, and meanwhile Standard & Poor's and Moody's were giving fraudulent investment advice on the quality of these mortgage-backed securities. It was a setup, okay? I mean, this is not rocket science. You don't have to be privy to the workings of these smoke-filled, walnut-paneled rooms to understand that the people who made these decisions that allowed this to go forward are the very people who are profiting immensely from it. And getting back to the police state issue, I would like to play here, Patricia, a clip about a film, a video you can find on YouTube if you search for FEMA, something like FEMA says founding fathers were terrorists, okay? I don't know that this guy is from FEMA, but he's apparently a federal official of some kind, and he's teaching one of these fusion centers, apparently, police officers, about what to look for and, you know, and how to fight terrorism, quote unquote. And this was filmed in July of 2001, before 9/11. And this is what they were telling these policemen.
Yeah, they're terrorists, but the bottom line is, to them, they are not. Now, why is that important to understand? Because they are as committed to their cause and to their way of life as you are yours. And they see you as being wrong. That's very different. When people are passionate about what they believe in, they become a very difficult enemy to be. Who was the first terrorist organization in the United States? Who?
Founding Fathers.
Founding Fathers. You mean Thomas Jefferson?
Oh, yes.
You mean George Washington?
Oh, yes.
Paul Revere?
Yes.
These guys right here, let me ask you something. Did they try to scare people?
Oh, yes.
They tried to intimidate the British. Did they use acts of violence? Your founding fathers, my founding fathers, were involved in acts of terrorism against British officials because they systematically had British officials assassinated. The guys who we call our founding fathers, George Washington, Mr. Honest, who cut down a cherry tree and admitted it, is the same guy who signed death orders, if you will, on members of the British government, the British Crown, who they wanted to eliminate because politically they had influence in certain pockets of the United States, at that time the 13 colonies, and they wanted to divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer. Boy, that really is the term here. They're dividing the police from the populace. They are brainwashing these police officers into thinking that there is no functional difference between the rebellious colonists in the 13 colonies who were ultimately rebelling against the policies of the Bank of England, and maybe we can get into that in some future show, basically rebelling against the very people who are apparently behind the scenes trying to take over this country as well as the rest of the world. And that's what I mean when I say that we're fighting against the very people that we declared independence from in 1776. You know, history does repeat itself.
I'm a little confused there.
Oh, go ahead.
So, I would think, okay, of course I tend to think kind of logically, I think, set me straight if I don't, that if that man was telling them that our founding fathers were terrorists, then how could it follow that terrorism would be bad because it freed this country from tyranny?
Well, you see, they're trying, in the minds of the police, they are trying to separate the cause, you know, the ideology, the objective of human rights versus imperial domination. They're trying to separate that moral issue, you know, and put it off on a shelf somewhere, and just trying to get them to home in on whether or not this group of people is using violence. You know, people have used it's unfortunate that people are pushed into a corner all the time and they use violence. You know, if you want to survive physically, sometimes you have to engage the enemy in the physical plane. That's all there is to it. And this is a form of brainwashing. They're telling these police that the British monarchy was on the same moral level as the people who were trying to, determine the fate of their own lives. And I have one more clip that summarizes, I think, pretty well for the listener, where further investigation needs to go. I mean, you can investigate 9/11, you know, till doomsday, and I guarantee if you open your mind to the ugly truth, you're going to discover blah blah blah. But the underlying issue really is who could have bought all of this influence, all this power? Who could have, you know, bribed all these federal officials or blackmailed them or murdered them? You know, there's a trail of dead bodies dating back to the 60s, you know, starting with JFK and before, of people who were a threat to the established order, and including Martin Luther King was killed by government officials. That's what the King family believes. That's what the jury in Memphis decided in 1999. And on and on and on. And it's not covered by the media. And it's barely covered, by the left press. I mean, obviously, the Institute for Policy Studies doesn't want to talk about it. And I don't know that Amy Goodman has addressed the issue in any depth for several years. I mean, her show, you know, she's done some great work, but her show suffers from some of the same problems as the mainstream media in that, there will be a brief exposure of some unbelievable scandal, and then it's quickly forgotten. So that the kids, you know, that are just getting out of high school, and that are vulnerable to the army recruiters that are trying to trick them into going abroad and fighting and destroying their health with depleted uranium and murdering innocent people on the basis of a lie. These kids need to be, you know, they need to understand what the situation is. And this is what I really find unconscionable, is that the left activist groups are not educating the kids. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, you know, when Vietnam was going on, we had these teach-ins. And so, you know, these young people would know, you know, what the hell's going on. And no one is telling them what's going on today, and I don't know if that's the fluoride in the water or what it is, but somehow the adults in the society have completely fallen down on the job. So I just want to play one quick clip from the floor of Congress. This is a repeat, actually. I played this last week also, but it bears repeating. It's a quick one.
In 1913, the money power of the country was taken away from the people by constitutional privilege. It belongs with the Congress, but it was given up in the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express, but yet it has the power to determine the direction of use of money in our economy.
There you go. This is the incredible truth. It doesn't get any more stark than that. These are the, you know, just by process of elimination, you know, money trumps everything. Money trumps ideas. It trumps politics.
Life.
Politics, religion. It trumps militaries. You know, you can, if you have enough money, you can go down to South America and buy yourself a republic. And it doesn't take, you know, it takes some planning and understanding of how to do it, and some time. But, you know, it happens all the time. It's been happening for decades. The people who have been overthrowing democratically elected governments in the third world for decades are now hell-bent on destroying this country. And what they intend to do, to the best of my understanding, is bring this country economically to its knees. And, you know, this is pretty much a foregone conclusion that this is going to happen. And then when people are totally desperate and starving in the streets and homeless and then the police are being called out to restore order in a completely outrageous status quo. That's when they expect that people will demand a strong man to, you know, take power and save the day. And this was the strategy that Western intelligence used when they installed Hitler, essentially, in the 30s. And actually, I'm hoping to get a guy on, Guido Preparata, who did his doctoral dissertation on this history, this secret history of financial flows and central bank actions concerning the rise of Hitler. Hitler openly bragged to the media that he had the full support of the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve. And, you know, he did not turn around, you know, the German economy. You know, there was a miraculous turnaround of the German economy after the collapse of the Weimar Republic. People were totally desperate. Hitler was brought into power to save the day. And as soon as Hitler took office, suddenly all of these major corporations, you know, the Ford Company, Standard Oil, and the central banks just started pouring money into the German economy. And you can see where if you can manipulate money at that level, given enough time, you can do pretty much anything, because money does trump everything in this world. Money represents real wealth, you know, resources, and ideas. I mean, it's been
made to, I mean, we have been programmed to believe that it is a real thing.
Right, it's not.
You know, so I think it's, again, a matter of deprogramming the populace, because if they realize that it's just an agreement, it's just a piece of paper, you know.
Right,
it's just a bunch of numbers.
It's a legal document. It's a legal document. People don't understand what money is. It's not something that you dig out of the ground, you know. It doesn't have to be tied to gold. And it doesn't have to be tied to the future labor of future generations. It's just an agreement between two people, and if you let it take on the meaning that the Federal Reserve notes have in this country, then you're basically, by accepting U.S. dollars as payment for debt, you are accepting the enslavement of your children.
Mm-hmm. You have just signed your life away. Is that what they call sell your soul to the devil?
That's right.
It's like, I have just agreed to this system that enslaves me with this little piece of paper. So now you have to jump through hoops so that you can get some of this stuff so that you can survive. When nobody has ever had to pay to live on planet Earth before, you know. It's an invention. It's a human invention.
Yeah. And it can serve humanity. I mean, money could be a great servant of humanity.
It could.
But it's been turned into an instrument of enslavement, and this country is totally enslaved on every level. Right? I mean, go ahead.
If they remove the greed factor, I think it would work.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell that we live in a slave society just by taking note of the fact that newborn babies are subjected to the prerogatives of the state, you know, and the medical industry, and they're turned into cash cows, and in the process they get traumatized. They get the best part of their sexuality cut off if they're little boys. They're alienated from their mothers. They're subjected to sensory deprivation and social isolation. You know, this is torture. And they torture these babies at birth, and they've been doing it for a very long time. And maybe if they stop doing that at some point, people would start being able to question the corruption that has so totally taken over the society.
That's how you cow people, is by traumatizing them.
Yeah.
So everybody who has been born in the United States and or circumcised in the United States and or lives in the United States, start working on clearing that trauma. Just noticing where the fear is and breathing into it. On my website, there's a thing called The Healing Place, where people can go, patriciarobinette.com or antipatricia.com. And And our, then they can start releasing that trauma.
And our show's website is thoughtcrimeradio.net, and I'm sorry I haven't put up the blog from last week, and I will try to get to that soon, as well as this week. So thanks for listening. It's almost 6 o'clock, and the next show is waiting in the wings. And I'm sorry.
Well, thank you, Rich.
I'm sorry I monopolized the hour with all these clips, but I hope that it was constructive.
They were very interesting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
And thanks for listening.